Pleased and honored to have so many of you join us here tonight. Tonight I feel is a celebration. We're here in celebration of a man whose spirit could not be broken after 27 years in jail. We're here. We're here to celebrate the spirit of education and academic freedom, which would allow diverging ideas to come forth and be heard on a college campus. And we're here to celebrate this campus because, students, I really want to let you know that without the full, complete support of this college campus, this event would not have happened. To coin a phrase from a friend, everyone, please look around, because if you want to know what love is, this is love tonight, because it wouldn't have happened without everyone here. And thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be able to introduce to you tonight Dr. Milton Brown. He is a professor of sociology at Pasadena City College. And he will be here tonight to come on and give us a little bit of background, because some of us don't really remember with the 60s. And for those... And for others, we might need a nice refresher, and he's going to come on and give us some knowledge. So please give a warm round of applause to Dr. Milton Brown.
I don't remember the 60s either. I'm too young. It's a real honor for me to be here tonight. And I mean that sincerely. I know we generally say that, but I mean that. When I was told about this event, having followed some of the travails of Brother Pratt over the years, I was elated. And I was deeply honored that Claudia asked me to give you a few words about the 60s, to kind of set the tone of the times in which this terrible occasion took place, when Geronimo Gijaga Pratt was incarcerated for something he did not do. And so I also know that this place is packed for the sole purpose of listening and seeing and experiencing Brother Pratt. And so I will be as brief as I can be in setting this tone so that we can get to what we're here for. The 60s were both a precursor to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, as well as a time when people concentrated on the present and tried to change it. It was a conscious living experience that transformed our minds, our bodies, our souls, for a moment at least. The 60s were perhaps a swing to the left of the social pendulum rather than a marker for permanent social change. In an oppositional culture such as the United States, the pendulum does not swing 180 degrees. How do I condense the 60s into just a few moments? So much was happening during those tumultuous, energizing, unforgettable years that one is hard-pressed to know where to begin. A revolution occurred, and it was televised. A government counterinsurgency took place against the revolution, and it was not televised. Youth not only in the United States but around the world drew the Maginot Line at the age of 30 and declared all on the other side to be their enemy. To be over 30 was to not understand, to not be trusted. To be under 30 was to be right with the world, to be valued as a warrior in the army of the righteous. We claimed goodness to be on our side, and we took to the streets to demand our right of moral supremacy. We were bold and courageous and naive and silly. What we won in the streets, we ultimately gave back as we turned 30 and cut our hair, smoked reefer indoors instead of on the street. Unlike Bill Clinton, I confess that I inhaled, but only once. We exchanged free love for socially boundaried promiscuity, rationalized our privilege as social moderates and economic conservatives, and put on our business suits to fight on the new battlefronts of personal gain. It was a time when the blare of heavy metal music played melody to the monotone magic of Bob Dylan, while the Beatles gave white soul to the rhythmic genius of Motown. Elvis, the Milli Vanilli of rock and roll, rose to the top of the popularity charts, while James Brown became the godfather of soul. The Temptations helped me to make love to my girl. And Bette Midler made East Village music a crossover experience. Jimi Hendrix made his guitar do things that B.B. King's Lucille would never think of trying. And Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones transformed the absurd into the sublime. Stevie Wonder put genius into the lexicon of the differently abled, while the Moments, Blue Magic, the Stylistics, and my all-time favorite, the Dells, caressed our emotions under the dim blue lights of somebody's, anybody's basement. Rock and roll and rhythm and blues did not just come along in the 60s. They were an integral part of the revolution. They expressed the soul of the revolution in syncopated time. It was a time when bell bottoms replaced peg pants and platform shoes gave rise to creative male fashion and painful fallen arches. Women threw off their bras, men burned their draft cards, and blacks grew mammoth fros and put on dashikis, their African identity blankets. Each statement was symbolic of a newfound freedom and unity. We were united in our independence from what we weren't exactly sure. It was a time when just being free was enough. A time when the Voting Rights Act, the Immigration Act, and the Civil Rights Act, outlawing historical practices of discrimination against people of color and women, were passed, marking yet again a new beginning in the war against inhumanity. So Latinos began to speak Spanish publicly and demanded bilingual education in public schools. Native Americans continued their long journey back to Wounded Knee and their rightful place as Native sons and daughters. Asians reunited with their ancestry, reestablished their culture and their communities, and became publicly proud and respected once again. And young whites naively sought their de-escalated social position of equality with humankind in a world of ultimate privilege. It was a time when McDonald's and the fast food revolution left mom's apple pie unbaked, and television enticed us to abandon the family dinner table for TV trays. Brown versus Board of Education paved the way for the Little Rock Nine, and the moral majority gave white backlash legitimacy. The concept of reverse discrimination was born prematurely, but survived to become strong and powerful, if not morally sound. It was a time when Martin, Malcolm, and Medgar died along the way with John and Bobby, so that Gloria, Betty, and Angela could take up the mantle and carry on. Cesar Chavez broadened our political consciousness about struggle against capitalist oppression beyond blacks and women, while Che Guevara helped us to link our individual struggles with others around the world. Nkrumah gave us conscientism from Ghana, and Mao gave us his revolutionary take on Marx's notion of dialectical materialism. Ralph Ellison, Paulo Freire, and Bobby Seale took us to new literary heights as Nikki Giovanni, Amiri Baraka, and James Baldwin cheered our bellies with poignant, politically impassioned prose. It was a time when the Vietnam War divided us along ideological lines, and when the young and poor went off to die so that the young and rich could pursue their manifest destiny. Muhammad Ali refused to fight, and raised our collective consciousness, while others lived their consciences in the exile solitude of Canada and Mexico. Jane Fonda colluded with the enemy and became a hero to young protesters, while the American rice cartel made billions from a captive market made from Agent Orange. America's children fought with their parents, and America's government fought with their future leaders. We were a beacon to the world of wannabe rebels and a challenge to the rhetorical ideas of freedom, justice, and equality for all. It was a time when John Wooden took UCLA to the Final Four, Jim Brown became Superman every Sunday afternoon, while O.J. carried USA and the Heisman Trophy to glory. Jackie Robinson's legacy catalyzed the integration of professional athletics, but left segregated those who owned the means of production, those who exercised power, and those who hoarded the profit. Sunday at 11 a.m. was still the most segregated hour in America, as God to more and more Americans became Allah, Yahweh, Buddha, Krishna, and deanthropomorphized universal consciousness. Sesame Street brought us a new awareness about the good television can do well before cable would lead us down those mean streets where Freddy Krueger lives. It was a time when drugs brought in by those who did not use them to communities that did not need them created a new front on which a different war would be fought. While Vietnam had not raised our consciousness, heroin and cocaine had dulled our senses. Black and brown communities that were relatively stable before the 60s imploded from decay and exploded in violence during the 60s. Young black men home from the inglorious horrors of Vietnam were denied equality, like their fathers who came home from the righteous wars of the Korean conflict and the Second World War were denied their GI Bill of Rights. Crime and criminals, the seeded offspring of hopelessness and despair, accompany drugs to the barrios, to the ghettos, from Watts to East L.A., to the west side of Chicago, to the north side of Newark, to Harlem, the South Bronx, and Brooklyn. With them came wealth to drug entrepreneurs, budget windfalls to law enforcement pimps, and stability to rural white communities, home to the burgeoning prison industrial complex. Prison populations, once the predominant domain of white criminals, especially in the North, became America's greatest victory against segregation. The 60s were times when the past eclipsed the future and the present stood still. While the race to the moon was leading us to new scientific horizons, our moral intransigence kept us mired in the muck of historical struggle to make our stated ideals our living reality. Each day was a continuation of the one that preceded it. Tomorrow was a concept, not a reality. It was today that was important. What one thought, what one felt, what one did was what was essential. But struggle and agitation of the youthful masses was inevitably no match against the inexorable societal will of the powerful to maintain their privilege. So drugs replaced slavery and law enforcement agencies replaced the Klan. The New York City Police Department's undercover agents' involvement in the assassination of Malcolm X, the CIA's incendiary relationship with the Weathermen Underground, and the FBI's counterinsurgency activities in the effort to destroy the Black Panthers all served to keep the plantation profitable and in the hands of the privileged, the owners. Malcolm was the defiant slave. The Weathermen were the abolitionists, and the Black Panthers were the field hands, standing up to the overseer and exercising black power through consciousness and organized will. They were a threat to America's inalienable right to culturally divide and conquer, a threat to America's inalienable right to culturally divide and conquer, a threat to America's inalienable right to oppress, a threat to America's inalienable right to commit genocide. Not only could the 60s be reasonably termed the Second Civil War, but the causes and the combatants look much like those from 100 years earlier. If there is no change, there is no change. The Weathermen broke the sacred taboo of white America to be silent by speaking out against the oppression against blacks, and Malcolm went too far by breaking the societal shackles of race and linking his cause with that of all oppressed peoples around the world. But it was the Black Panthers, yesterday's militia, who instilled the greatest fear in the minds and hearts of over 30 white, black, brown, yellow, and red America. Most revolutionaries were fighting for the right of all to play by the same rules, while the Black Panthers were demanding new rules and new players. It was the Black Panthers who denounced Planned Parenthood as a genocidal attack on the black community. It was the Black Panthers who created a movement to feed hungry black children after the government and the American people had turned their collective backs with indifference. And it was the Black Panthers who designed and implemented the first African-centered education programs aimed at creating a greater consciousness among the children whose image and being had been whitewashed out of institutionalized learning circles. So the journey of Geronimo Jijaga Pratt is no aberration, no illusion of justice gone wrong this one time. How many black and brown young men are in prison today because the wealthy, who commit more crimes against humanity and society with far more devastating effect, have the power to make us look down the socioeconomic ladder rather than up to define what is crime and who are the criminals? How many lives are lost, families destroyed, dreams transformed into nightmares, minds wasted, souls disconnected from their spiritual reservoir because Americans would rather build prisons than rebuild communities? How are these socially defined realities different from those the youth of America waged war against in the 60s? No, Geronimo Jijaga Pratt's journey is no aberration, no illusion of justice gone wrong. His story is America's story, our historical legacy as a gift to the 90s. Geronimo Jijaga Pratt's 27 years in prison was in nearly all respects analogous to the 27 years spent in prison by Nelson Mandela. Their imprisonments were orchestrated events. They were threats to the social order, for the same reasons to maintain power and privilege, and by the same people, the wealthy. The struggles of Mandela and Pratt for freedom and justice were subverted for a brief moment in universal time. But just as truth crushed to earth rises again, justice denied becomes a wellspring for renewed struggle. The 60s lives, ladies and gentlemen, and is with us here tonight. Thank you.
I'd just like to say that as a student in the Cross Cultural Center, I felt very strongly about bringing Geronimo Gijaga to our campus to speak to us of the struggle that we share for equality, of his experiences as a social revolutionary, and of his experiences as a political prisoner. I know a lot of us have strong feelings about this case and about social issues, oppression, the byproducts of oppression, and so on. But I'd like to say this because I think it's important that regardless of what our position is on this case and what our thoughts may be about Geronimo, we can still look to the facts of the matter as they stand on their own and see that an injustice occurred. The fact is that FBI telephone traces and eyewitnesses had placed Geronimo Gijaga in Oakland, California, at the time of the murder for which he was convicted that occurred in Santa Monica, California. This information was withheld from the jury that convicted him of murder, and this is not justice. It's a travesty that our American government system, which claims to provide justice for all, has failed in providing justice for Geronimo Gijaga. And it is to this very point that in May of this year, a judge found that Geronimo had not been given a fair trial, and he is currently without any conviction. He was in prison for 27 years, but he is with us here tonight, a free man. And on behalf of the Cross Cultural Center and all of our sponsors, it is with great pleasure that we welcome you, Geronimo Gijaga, to Pasadena City College.
Mandela. Thank you. Sante. Sante sana. Gracias. Arigato. Aho. I'm trying to say thanks in every language I could remember because this is really touching to see so many. And thanks to the Cross Cultural Center, that's what it's all about. So many brothers and sisters coming together to make something happen. And I can't say thank you enough. I can't say asante enough. And I also want to give thanks to the elders, like I always do before I start trying to convey these words to you that I'm not so adept at doing. Because like I tell everyone, my role in the movement was not the one behind the mic. And I make no bones about it, and I try to do the best I can in conveying these messages to you that many who are left behind those walls asked me to do. But before I go any further, I also want to thank Claudia, who just left the mic, for the pains and the great work she did with my wife, Ashaki, in bringing this about. It wasn't easy to do with the way things are going since I've been out. So I really want to thank Claudia and Carrie, who was at it earlier. And I was so touched by the professor who, he said it all. I mean, trying to fight, you know. And he's the president of the Malcolm X College of Chicago also. He's a very great man, Malik Elias Shabazz College. And I would be remiss if I would not also give a special thanks and salute to our mayor, my friend, my brother, old Paparian, Bill Paparian, Mayor Paparian, who, if y'all would indulge me a minute, about a few years ago, before anyone thought I was coming out, Paparian got in contact with my family and said that he had read some information about my case and he couldn't believe it and he had to do something. And from then on, it's just like it's been so touching. I know most of you know him, and it was especially touching because I had told him that all my life in California, it seemed like every time I run into an Armenian, they were trying to kill me. And I finally, with the exception of Charles Gary, of course, but I'm Philobostrian, Duke Majan, Calustrian, and it was like, damn, I was a Turk or something that had done something to the participate in that Holocaust, but that wasn't true. But he made sure that he and the good priest was represented in that. And I really wanted to thank him with all my heart for what he's done. He's a very exceptional man. I can't thank him enough. It's hard to try to, after 27 years, come and make you understand that during those 27 years, you've been told a lot of stories, like we say down home, a lot of lies and a lot of untruths. And I've always dealt with truth. I could have left prison a long time ago. They offered me big money. I could have escaped. But you charged me with a murder I didn't do. I'm not going nowhere until you clear it up. And I will tell you, I don't care. You know, that woman had a life. Mrs. Carolyn Olson had a life that was used like so many of us was used and expended. And her life was wasted by these vicious programs. And I wanted to know. I wanted the truth to come out. But I was in a hole. They put me in a hole for the first 8 years. No visits. They attacked me. All I wanted to do is expose the truth. Everything about the revolution, everything about everything else got to be on hold. I want to expose the truth that my mother did not raise a murderer. And don't put that on me. And that Mrs. Olson, we learned, was a very progressive person who was a part of the anti-war movement at the time. And strangely enough, she's dead, I'm in prison. But something is not working here, you know. So I wanted to expose that. I didn't know about Nixon then. I didn't know about COINTELPRO then. But I knew something was amiss. And I knew it was more than the little peons they had around here in the L.A. and area LAPD, and Sheriff's Department, who was playing their little FBI games. I knew it was more than that. But at the time, we did not know that Richard Nixon and his girlfriend, J. Edgar Hoover, had plotted to kill and destroy one of the most beautiful movements that history has ever seen. And these sick individuals were allowed to get away with it. And when it was exposed, and I was in Folsom Prison facing sadistic guards who were shooting us with guns and all kind of manipulated prisoners who were trying to stab and kill. While this was going on, Nixon is being exposed, if you're old enough to remember during the Watergate hearings, as a criminal. And later on, J. Edgar Hoover and all the rest of them. So it stands to reason if they're exposed as criminals and they're the ones who put us in prison, then we can't both be criminals. So I wondered, well, what's happening? But I'm in prison. We didn't have TVs and radios back then. We hardly got any mail. We hardly got any visits back during those years, those first 8 years in prison. So communications was hard coming both in and out. But it would baffle me what is going on. This man has been exposed as one of the worst criminals that ever sit in that house. And all of the details of the Watergate papers, everything that was revealed during the all the corruption around Vietnam and the attacks against the Black Liberation Movement and other movements, the Asian Liberation Movement, the Mexican Liberation Movements, all of the movements back then, the Native Liberation Movement, no one was left untouched. And nothing was being done. Oh, he's going to be kicked out of office. You know, we're going to do that and we're going to send him, you know, we understand. It was strange that we went to San Quentin and he went to San Clemente. It didn't add up. Now here's this man who's responsible for the death and destruction of so much. You know, so this is one of the things that I always try to encourage people to wake up, because there's so much has led you down paths that have you believing that when you see me 27 years later, that you come up to me and you ask me for an autograph. And I love you for your sentiment, but it tells me that you don't know who I am. I'm not a movie star. You said, I don't mean to hurt your feelings. It happens everywhere I go that I did not join a movement to sign autographs. I did not join a movement to become world renowned for fortune or fame or for your money or for anything. I joined a movement to win. And that's the bottom line. And it's very natural for people who are in that business, such as movie stars, to promote themselves. They come up, they give you an autograph. But you asked me that, and I want to put the name after I explain to you, because I don't want to hurt your feelings, because I know you're coming in good spirit. But I have to explain that to you. We are under collective discipline not to promote ourselves. We cannot promote ourselves. We can only promote the revolution, the struggle. We do not promote personalities. We promote principles. So with that, please understand that a person who stays in a situation and struggles in a situation such as what's going on with Rochelle McGee, with Hugo Pinnell, with Leonard Peltier, Suni Ada Akali, Dr. Mutulu Shakur, Marilyn Buck, Susan Rosenberg, on and on and on, that we don't care if you form committees out here and say, free this person, free that person. If you put our names on posters, we didn't join the movement for that. We didn't join the movement saying that we get busted, we're going to turn around and sit in those prisons and criticize everybody in the country because they're not coming to our aid. We understood that we were making that sacrifice. And we did not expect, this is why I'm so surprised, that the people will adopt and champion these causes that are worthy, and rightly so, by the way. But I'm trying to tell you how we look at it. With Mumia sitting up there on death row, he understands when he joined, just like we all did, that we were going to go to prison, that we were going to be driven underground, that we were going to be killed, that we were going to be exiled, because we knew the nature of our enemy. And if you think anything other, you're playing a dangerous game, because we are faced with a very vicious enemy. Now, how to define that enemy, that's another question. You hear a lot of people, especially in the New African, what we call New African or black communities, them white folks this, white folks that, the white folks mistake. Our enemies cannot be defined by race. That's a big mistake. Now, you got to be careful with that. In fact, a further caution is that you better watch that brother next to you and that sister next to you a lot of cases, because that's something that has to be worked out, and it's endemic in every ethnic group, every national liberation movement that takes place not only in this country but throughout the world, because they're heavily infiltrated with people who like to play cops, who like to operate from that premise of what Che Guevara used to refer to as mechanical discipline, and get the big buck mercenarily to go and to do anything that old master tell him to do or her to do. So stay very cautious about these things, and be very cognizant of the fact that our enemies has to be known. Sun Tzu said, know your enemy and know yourself. In 1,000 battles, you will never be defeated. You have to define your enemies accurately, else you're going to be defeated time and time again. If someone sends their killer dogs after you, are you going to spend the rest of your life plotting and trying to kill those killer dogs, or getting at the people that train them and kill them? It's as simple as that. We have to study and become more sophisticated in our approach to solving these problems. And trying to bring forth the truth after 27 years, and I see all these misconceptions of, oh, he's a movie star. And I can understand that. I don't blame you. I see brothers that were and sisters who were with us in the 60s. I see them. I don't even recognize them. They're around here talking about selling the Black Panther. Now, I'm going to sell the Black Panther party. One in Dallas, I just left Dallas a few days ago, down there trying to copyright the Black Panther Party so other people can't use the name. He went to the judge, and some people using the name. He tell the judge, we want injunction, we want to put in jail the real Panthers. I mean, it blows my mind, especially after Bunchy has died, George has died, Fred Hampton, Little Mark, Fred Bennett, so many, Carl Hampton. I mean, so many have died. So many are still in prison. And these people are out here what we call black power pimps, doing this. And it's wrong. And they see me coming and they hide. The dude who was doing that wouldn't come to the meeting in Dallas, because he came around 74 when there was no more Panthers as we knew it. They were all pimps and Superfly, and they had been infiltrated, and they were promoting Democratic Party principles, which was not the original intent, and it had been usurped and co-opted by then. And when you study history, you will learn that. So he wouldn't come because he couldn't face the truth. So hopefully that will be resolved, but it's happening all over. Where I go, I try to explain the truth as we know it. You have to understand that we join in struggling in this movement not to be a part of no Democratic Party. We join because we believe, as we still do today, that Africans in this country constitute the second largest African nation in the world. Next to Nigeria, we constitute the second largest in the world. We have the wherewithal to fill an entire nation. We have over $600 billion a year go through our nation. We have the brain power that will surpass any, I think, of the world. We have the skills, we have carbon, we have a common language, common culture, common everything. We still turn around and call Clinton our president. This don't seem right to us. You see, we have a right to elect our own leadership, to govern our own selves. And this is what we fought for. Read the 10 point of the programs of the Panthers, of other organizations back in the 60s. And it states very clear that we call for a United Nations supervised plebiscite to let it be known what we want, not some hand-picked leaders that you put and impose upon us who tell you, oh, we want this. They do not speak for us. Let us speak for ourselves. And we've been calling for this for years. This country prides itself on democratic principles, on democracy. Well, to us, this is the epitome of that. The plebiscite. We don't want y'all involved in it. We want the United Nations to supervise it, because we don't trust the United States. And it's as clear as that. If they're involved in it, I'm not going to have anything to do with it. But the referendums and the surveys we took in the 60s, if you remember, even Newsweek did one, I think in 1969. And they polled all throughout the country, and it came back 92% in support of not only the Black Panther Party, but nationhood, national independence. Then right after that, they escalated their COINTELPRO attacks. It's a shame for us to be so large, so huge, so capable, so qualified, that we still turn around and let old massa could patrol our communities while our children are dying with this dope, send our children to their schools where they miseducate them and confuse them with this cultural invasions. It's a shame that we have not called for a state of emergency at the alarming rate in which our young men and women are going to prison. And we're sitting down here. It's a shame. And you're going to the White House. You're going to Capitol Hill. You're going to someone else. Old massa, can I do this? Can I start this program? Old massa, yeah, you could do that. Give you a few million and turn around and build 50 prisons behind your back and hire your nephews and your nieces to work in the prisons to shoot us and to kill us. I just left them. I just left little brother, a little Crip, standing up arguing with another Crip. Didn't throw no blows. Before he knew it, a bullet goes through his head, the whole back of his head blown out, right there in Tehachapi Prison. I was there. He didn't even throw a blow. We looked. The guard that killed him was blacker than midnight. A black-ass guard. The same way in Soledad. Same way in Fort. You got Mexican guards killing young, beautiful, promising Mexican prisoners. It's a damn shame they got you killing your own sons and daughters. And you sit down here, and we don't do nothing about it. It should be a state of emergency, that this is a form of genocide. These prisons are nothing but tools that's used to further this war of genocide against peoples of color especially. And it's a shame if you can see what they're doing to the black and the brown prisoners in those prisons today. It was a shame when I went in, but it ain't nothing like it is today with those young brothers coming in, confused, not knowing, meaning well, coming from a street that then gave them drugs, that then victimized them, to call them gang, blamed them. When you know it's coming from Langley, Virginia. And you're going to blame those young brothers. Well, you drove by and shoot. You manipulate. Let's talk. We're in college right now. Let's talk about some philosophy. Let's talk about indeterminism versus determinism. Let's talk about free will versus lack of free will. Let's talk about at what point does a person become a criminal, and at what point does society put him in that situation where he can do no other. Let's talk philosophy, if you want to get at it from that angle. Either way you look at it, it's wrong. Like the brother professor just said, they are the worst criminals in the world up there. And everybody knows it. They do not do one day behind those walls. That has to change. We don't want to put anybody in prison. I advocate the abolition of prison. I'm known as a prison abolitionist. I think we can create societies where there won't be a need for prison. I think people with the hearts of a Bill Paparian can exist and can multiply and can flourish, where we can get along together and we can regulate ourselves in a social, civilized way that we won't need any prisons. I really believe that, because I've looked into the souls of brothers who's come in those prisons of all nationalities who didn't need to be there also, and who were manipulated, who were more or less put in that situation. We give the analogy of the pool cue hitting the cue ball hitting the four ball hitting the seven ball. At what point did it begin? Are you going to blame that eight ball when it falls in the pocket for falling in the pocket? Are you going to blame the four ball for hitting the eight ball? Or the three ball for hitting the four ball? Or the cue stick for hitting all that? So it's a concatenation that deserves and is worthy of study. You cannot understand anything in isolation. When you try to do that, you confuse yourself and you become a willing servant of the powers that be, who are quickly at your side to manipulate you. Here, what you want? Because they know you stomp. Because you did not see the interconnecting events that led up to this. But if I was a Rockefeller or some of those rich people, their names won't come to me right now, and I do a crime, then you're going to say, oh, the Twinkie defense, oh, he ate some Twinkies. Or he did thus and so. And it doesn't matter what color you are. As you know, I don't want to mention any cases. It doesn't matter what color you are. You got that money, you're not going to prison. If you do, you're coming right out. They're going to put you in a country club, and you're coming right out because money talk. But this brother who don't have this money, who don't have these situations, you condemn him to death. You put him on these yards. You put sadistic guards who hasn't even finished college, don't even have GEDs over them with 30-30s, and manipulate them to get in little arguments so they can shoot them. That's murder. That's one of the coldest forms of murder I've ever seen in my life. To sit there and see where that balcony is? They don't be that high with those guns. And I was a sharp shooter, expert in the service. That close with high-powered rifles. And you ought to see their bodies when they get through shooting them. And don't let another one be stabbing them. This is one of the ugliest things you're ever going to see. And it's more prevalent in the California prisons than anywhere in the country. And they put all this propaganda out. You go for it. You vote for these resolutions and these initiatives to build more prisons. It's not the solution. You continue. You're creating a monster so large that you're not going to be able to control. And it's already out of control. And guess who it's going to come back on?